Okay, so last week we were... I left the book at home. Last week we spoke about the milking cow controversy that took place in Israel because it's related to Dash. And I had this great book on Rav Kook. Reread the few pages over Shabbos. I put it by a bookshelf and I forgot to snag it this morning on way at the door. But it's okay, so we got to rely on. So this is, we touched on this last week. Rav Kook was very, very, very against milking cows on Shabbos by a Jew. Vehemently against. And that led to either one of two options. Either it led to a Jew milking a cow totally li'ibud, meaning that these Dutch cows, which produce a tremendous amount of milk, needed to be milked every single day or they would lose their milk or get very sick. You had to milk them. Option A was a non-Jew. Option B was a Jew. The problem with a Jew is, of course, it's Dash, as we saw last week. Rav Yishroim hold that it's considered Dash. Then we said, we saw this last week. Then we said, okay, what about having Le'ibud? So yes, that is one solution. There's no choice. You could milk a cow and then dispose of all of the milk. The problem with that would be that to lose 1/7 of what a cow produces every week, you know, Yom Tov is, it's only one day Yom Tov. It's not, you know, Yom Tov doesn't amount to that much that you'd lose, especially on many years where Shabbos and Yom Tov sometimes overlap. And you'd have a scenario where the milking industry, the milk industry in Israel would not be able to function because their profit margin was not 1/7. The profit margin was less than that. And therefore, if they lose 1/7 of the profits because Shabbos' milk would go to waste, they would go bankrupt. This led to a very controversial matter. And it allowed, the only thing that they would do is have a non-Jew. And that already, that solution was provided by the Shulchan Aruch hundreds of years ago, right? That in fact is what you could do, have a non-Jew do it. However, if a non-Jew milks a cow, what's the status of the milk? So you have Chav Yisrael issues, which you spoke about, although you could have a Jew standing there to oversee it. And the other issue that we said was milks it for the day, meaning, which isn't the biggest deal, because you can just use it the next day. So you'd have to make sure that when Mr. Chris in Europe somewhere, although I don't think the Jews were that involved in the dairy industry in Israel, but okay, if it in Europe, but whatever happened, okay, you make it, you figure it out, and you can deal with it on Sunday. And at least from an economic perspective, you would not be losing 1/7 because you could sell it. And let's face it, okay, sell it tomorrow, sell it the next day. That's not that's fine. That's not a big deal. But that was not good enough. And the reason why it was not good enough was because in the land of Israel, you had three issues that were going against having non-Jews. One, you had a security issue, and they were worried about bringing non-Jews in Israel to various farms, simply because it was a danger, because they were Arabs, and Arabs living in the land of Israel, we're talking about, you know, early 20th century, tensions really were quite high, and therefore a security issue. Security risk, anyways. The second issue that the community faced was, I think we saw a situation where there was the Israeli government said we can't have Arabs come in because of disease, because they were bringing in diseases in that, and if one cow contracted this disease, it could wipe out and cause tremendous financial and health concerns to the local community. So that's another reason why they didn't want to bring Arabs. And three, you couldn't always find Arabs in certain places. It wasn't like they had Arabs living everywhere in the land of Israel. It was certain pockets. And so a kibbutz was living in an area where, like Bnei Brak, you can't necessarily find Arabs everywhere, in which case you had three things that often made it quite difficult. And the fourth matter, which was more... what sort of hashkafic, I guess you could say, is, well, part of the hashkafot of the Zionist movement, at least for sure in the religious Zionist movement, was we need to be able to operate self-sufficiently. We're going to have a Jewish government that you need a non-Jew, meaning you now need a non-Jew to function economically. That goes against the Zionist ideal. We're not self-sufficient. We need non-Jews to help run our economy, our country, our livelihood, our dairy farming situation. Whereas Rav Kook said, if you want to buy a cow, before you even buy cows, make sure that you can get a non-Jew to work for you every single Shabbos. Okay? Whereas Rav Kook said, this is a prerequisite. Don't even go into these industries unless you know you have this situation which was taken care of. Okay. Now, what ended up happening, and Rav Kook was even against really even having Jews leibud. He really didn't even like that heter, so to speak. When this question was posed to Mishpate Uziel, Rav Uziel, in the late 40s, I think early 50s, at least it was 1952 or 53, something like that. It was the first decade, the first few years of the state of Israel. This was a major, major crisis. And I think we did this already last week, right? And so that is source 4 in that handout. And he said that he offered 4 conditions. Let's just go there very, very quickly. 1, he said, make it all your day clean. First of all, he said, for sure, try to get a non-Jew to do it. Okay, once you can't do that, he said that the milking should be done, bottom of page 2, should be done with a kli and not be a dayim. Right? That's what his first suggestion. Then he said, 2, it should be done bitzina, it should be done privately, meaning you shouldn't make a big, spectacle of this. 3, mamish, you can't find a non-Jew. There's no one in sight. Right? And 4, he said, it should be done the bare minimum. Whatever the minimum is, it's not like you have a blanket head there. You can kind of milk and do whatever you want. Those were essentially the 4 suggestions. Again, against Rav Kook. Now, it's much easier to go against Rav Kook in the early 50s because he passed away. So it's much easier to go against somebody who's no longer alive than when he's in your face and writing letters to you. Now, so... that's just a very, it's much more helpful. As opposed to, it's actually very interesting when Rav Kook, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this book in. I remember this article, I think it was an undergrad, I don't know, we're talking 25 years ago probably. 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So in there it discussed this psak of milking on Shabbos. And they used, there was a big rav in New York at the time who gave the heter. I guess there were dairy farms in America. I guess there was some Jewish religious farmings in America. And he worked with them. And at the same time, they were asking him questions. But it's very, very odd that the yeshuv is asking the rabbi in America about, and he was willing to take on Rav Kook. I guess it's easier to take on somebody when you're a few, in those days, you're thousands of miles away, and and communication is much more complicated. So, okay. So he wrote a letter to you, wrote a letter back, and then 6 months later, you get a response, right? So it was a different type of communication of some sort. But okay, that's what it was in those days. So, and what makes it fascinating was that you have the Chazon Ish, who comes up with a head there, in many ways, much more, at least from a Zionist perspective, viable against Rav Kook, who was seen to be the great religious Zionist. In many ways, the Chazon Ish was not, Bnei Brak, who comes up with a much more favorable psak from a Zionist perspective, a Shkafically Zionist, right? By the way, this comes up, there's another battle. Once I started reading that article, I wanted to read a bunch of them. And the other point that I'll just mention was Rav Kook was vehemently against women voting in Israel. Felt it was a violation of many, many, many principles, even though many Haredi, a good Rosh Yisrael, rabbis in America, for sure, and in Israel, permitted it. Rav Kook. So those were two, though. So when people talk about, Rav Kook, people don't realize that, yes, he's one who kissed land of Israel, and he was very close with the secular Jews, which many people were critical of him against. He was a very principled person. That was who he was known for. So when he had a principle, this was the way it was. L'chumra or l'kula. So the two areas he was very machmir on, which is against Hashkafic Zionism, was only allowing non-Jews to milk, and women were not allowed to vote. So very interesting, just as a... Okay, that's for a topic for another time. But the Chazon Ish, if you take a look at 5, I think you can read that. It's really, really small. I have an advantage. I can enlarge it on my computer. But he says like this. He says the following. And this is revolutionary. V'nira l'fizeh. So flip the page. We're on page 3. V'nira l'fizeh. D'mutar l'halbish atzinur didea para. You can attach a suction cup. That's not the right word to use at all. But like a tube. Thank you. A tube is a much better word to use. To the testes of the cow. Zadar. Okay. Shesif tenuas achashmal lavo. That what's going to happen? That electricity will eventually flow there. Al yedei ptichat shaon. That what will happen is, so two things are going to happen. You're going to be set on a tick, 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 tick on a timer. And eventually, so you place these suctions from the udder. And eventually the clock is going to turn on and the suction is going to begin. By the way, this is already, this is a long time ago. And this flow will milk the cow. She'ein zo ela grama. This is considered a grama. Why is it a grama? Because I'm not doing anything. I'm putting it here, meaning I as in a human being, a Jew, on Shabbos, waiting 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, an hour later, it goes on by itself. So my action, I'm not doing anything. Right? What am I doing? So he said this is a grama. Now, I know this is going to happen. Is this considered moksha? Is this considered a grama by a daraisa? So we did see, although he didn't mention here, we did see in the Mishpat, when we saw the longer explanation last week, he does reference that there are Rishonim who hold that Chaliva on Shabbos is not a daraisa. It's very difficult. I touched on it last week. It's a very difficult sugya. But the Rambam and Rashi holds is daraisa and it's dash. There is a minority opinion who holds it's mamachek, that it's smoothing, and others even hold that it's only a derabana. But the Rov Rishonim and the Psak Shulchan Arach and the most poskim is that it is a daraisa of dash. But, can you use it? And Mishpatevzio did want to mention there's a tzad lahakel. Oh, maybe in this case where there's a massive financial loss and it's. And Tzar Balei Chaim to rely on minority opinion of Rishonim. We did see that last week. But it's funny, though, in the summary, I actually didn't mention that. So again, back to the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish here is saying that since, after all, it's a grama, and that's causing, therefore, might be permissible. V'chen mutar lahalbish et tzinur bizman tenuat hachashmal. You'd even be allowed to place this tzinur when there's actual flow. Chav olech li'ibud. When, what? And this is the other thing. The chalav, the milk goes li'ibud. When the milk goes to be wasted, to be spilt on the ground. But it'd be forbidden once it's flowing, once it's on, you'd not be allowed to actually connect it and have this milk go into a kli, a bucket, a basin to collect it. Why? That's not a grama. That's mamish, a malacha, mamish. Kevan shebekoch rishonasa chaliva v'chiv al the chiv, it would be considered. What does that say? Ritzicha? What? Have the chai of all. Tzicha? Oh, you say that's considered killing somebody. I see, right. Meaning if you were to put a machine. What? Right. I mean, it's not a grama. It's not a grama. Okay, basically. Meaning if it's already going, you placing it there, that's not considered a grama. That's basically be a dime. Like you're killing somebody. Okay? Good. Thank you. So that is important because we see here that the Chazon Ish is willing to allow a grama. And this was what the farms used. They used milking pipes and tubes and all the suctions all on a timer. So, but a Jew had to place them there that they couldn't get around. And that's what they did. Now, later on, and I'm not gonna, we'll just, we'll, we'll, Oh, whoopsie, that was not good.
Why is it an issue of placing that it's done before Shabbos?
They couldn't do it before Shabbos. They had to do it on Shabbos. They had no choice. They had to do it on Shabbos. You couldn't do it before. I would trap them. What? Yeah, it's not comfortable. It's. But put it on at 7 p.m. Friday evening, only to milk them, only have milk 12 hours later? Oh, yeah, you're probably right, right? You probably have to do that too, right? How many machines do you actually have to do this?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's good. For sure that was true. Now, what else? So later on, and I didn't mention this, and I want to just pick up the pace though because I've got to finish this topic today. But one other point which I think is interesting to note, later on they actually invent two things which make what would be considered in Israel mahadrin milk. That if you just use a timer, they still didn't like that. And they added two new components, and that now all mahadrin milk in Israel, which is basically all milk, I think, has three things that they do. One, this was added about 20 years ago, was that the first spritz that comes out of the milk was placed in a small little test tube that was le'ibud, meaning that the first amount of milk that was drawn was discarded and not used. And therefore, the only milk that they actually ended up using was the second va'ilach. So therefore, it was already going, in a sense, it was already in the process. It was a grama. It was a grama to begin with. And the first part was li'ibud. And then it was just once you had this pula, which is nimshachet, more room to be leaning. Then they got into a much fancier scenario where you didn't even need to have a Jew place the actual suction on the cow itself, whereas it was done robotically. And that, obviously, was super cool, and you no longer needed biyadayim of a Jew. That was obviously transformational from a halachic perspective. And that's basically now what all refets use. There'll be a guy there who's overseeing it in case there's like a problem, and he might have to do some kind of tweaks to make sure things are moving in the right direction, but that now is what's done in the farms in Israel, which is pretty cool. So
seems like you still need to have some hands-on.
You're getting a little bit, but it's like they're like off already, and it's not part of the milking process, and they can move the machines over with the machinery. Like it's much, yeah. So that's now basically pretty standard in all dairy farms in Israel. So I don't think there's a kosher dairy farm in America, Canada today. I'm sure there are Jews who maybe own some of them or partially own some of them, maybe all of them, but I don't believe there's any that are done like Kadin, and they're just like, yeah.
How do you certify milk which is milk in Shabbos, and like you don't know when it's going to be sold?
So what? Because in Israel or here?
Well, in here in the West.
So it doesn't matter because it's all done by non-Jews, right? Yeah. So once everything's done by non-Jews, mm-hmm. and the cow is not owned by really a Jew,
even if it was
vaday milked on Shabbos by a non-Jew, owned by a non-Jew, and it's first of all, it's probably batel too, right? It's not like, you know, Saturday's milk is what you get Tuesday, right? I'm sure in these vats, they're stored and they get mixed in. Saturday's milk is mixed in with Fridays and Thursdays, and then not shipped out, right?
But you don't need that, right?
No, you wouldn't even need that product, right? There's, I don't want to get into milk because there is an issue of trefa of milk. That's a big deal. But anyways, that's enough for now. Okay, and take a look, and that's what you have there in source number 6. Mutu lemor le'ino Yehudi lachlov behemto v'shabas mishun tzar v'lechaim shachalav metzaira v'chalav asur bo bayom. We said that before, right? That you need to, you can't get any benefit from it, you have to leave it there. Which again is a bit of a challenge in the olden days, right? When you didn't have these machines. You know, you have a non-Jew milk it, it would sit in these, vessels, and you had to make sure that they were covered properly so other animals or bugs wouldn't get in there. It's not that simple. We did this already. You have to sell this to the non-Jew. Okay. Fine. Let's talk about two other components to it. And one is nursing. How do we allow... Well, that's great with cows. What about with humans, right? How do we allow nursing on Shabbos? And there is actually a major issue that comes up fairly regularly for women who are nursing. Sura 7, you know, some of you, you know, have siblings who do those things, right? Mutar li'isha kalach ma'chalav kadei shi'achos atina kadar v'yoneg. So everyone, of course, a baby's allowed to nurse on Shabbos. That's a given. That's the way the baby eats. But what about sometimes a woman needs to express a little bit of milk first in order for the baby to be like, oh yeah, I got to start sucking. It's actually pretty amazing that a baby is born with a sucking reflex, because if they don't, they're not going to live. So somehow it's one of those things that it knows to do, which is pretty pretty amazing. It knows kind of where to go. Sometimes women have to. So the question that the Shulchan Aruch is dealing with, can a woman, it was called express milk? The answer is yes. How could that be? It's chalav. No, since it's a prerequisite, since it's part of the eating process of the baby, therefore it's permissible. But this is an important Ramah. Aval asur la'atiz ma'chalav al mishu nashaf baruch ra. Madleit bosakana. Now, I'm not saying this is popular today, but they used to somehow, a woman's breast milk was, I guess, used for some types of people, non-babies. That would be forbidden to do, unless, of course, there's a sakana that's involved. And she would not be allowed to, if you take a look at source number 8, she would not be allowed to. Lo tekel isha chalav medida l'tocha kos o l'tocha k'dira v'tenek v'tinek et Bina. She would not be allowed to express her milk into a cup or into a vessel and then give that to the baby. Now, this is a major issue for women who nurse. And the reason is because sometimes if the baby isn't taking enough milk, a woman can get full and she needs to express her milk. And if she expresses her milk, sometimes it's easier to just save it, right? So she could pump, and there's a way to pump. There's a manual pump. There's an electric pump. A woman could pump. Electric pump, in theory, of course, you have to just set up for Shabbos on a timer. But women could do those pump, or women could, you know, use a manual pump. And then this way you can have breast milk, which is saved for later, and you can put that into a bottle, and the husband could then do a shift, you know, in the middle of the night, as opposed to the wife having to be up. Or if she has a lot of it, you know, you can save it for a time when her supply is low or when she has to go to work or go to school, and someone else could then give the baby breast milk. So this, but she would not be allowed to save that milk on Shabbos. And so, but because there's tsar that's involved, she would be allowed to pump, but the milk would have to go to Ibud. How do you do that? You put soap at the bottom of your dish, and then when a woman pumps into it, since it's soapy, it's the ibud. Since it's not drinkable, that would be permissible. However, you ask the average woman to do all that work and to get nothing out of it is psychologically very damaging, right? Because it's not easy, you know, pumping. So they really don't like that option at all. Now, if there's a case where there's a sakana and you have no choice and she needs to save it because, you know, then this is what to talk about, but on a regular vanilla case, she would not be allowed to pump on Shabbos and have that milk be saved for another time. But rather, only heter, unless there's, like, you know, medical reasons. Otherwise, she would need to, obviously, regular nursing would be fine. Even having her express milk would also be okay. Okay? So this is not just a cow issue. This is also a very serious human issue as well. And that's the Bir Halacha number 9. Ayin the prima guardian de la chalov me adam the toch kli yeshba iso doraisa mishum afarek for aser bishvil cholash in bosakana lo al yedei eno yehudi, right? And you would not be allowed to do this. The chemucha chemishonim velenek bepfemi isha mishum refuah mashma. Take a look at the trumas adeshin dishba zisu doraisa de lo dami liyonek me behema debisha in derech lachov ki in liyonek de tzarech yom bazes. Okay, so what we see here, and this is kind of what I was saying before, is that we only allow it under certain circumstances, but otherwise a classic case of just express a woman pumping to reserve for later would be very problematic on Shabbos, or for that matter on Yom Tov too. It wouldn't matter here at all, Shabbos or Yom Tov. Okay. My sister-in-law had that. This was a major issue for her because she had twins. And what happens when you have twins is that the amount of pumping and the amount of feeding that you have to do is enormous. And there were, and because they were preemies, they were born at 25 weeks, so she couldn't feed her boys for a very long time. In fact, actually, probably never. But the hospital wanted her milk. So, oh wow, Baruch Abba. Oh, I have something for you. It's in my car. Oh, it's not destroyed.
I heard drugs stay well, so I'm a little bit about it.
What was that?
Drugs usually preserve pretty well.
So. Oh. It was in a bag, so like a bag in my car is more dangerous than it survives. What was I saying? So my sister-in-law. So that issue there was she needed to pump sometimes in order to give it to the hospital because the hospital needed to have it at all times. So that was a big shala for her, that she'd be allowed to pump or not since they needed it. So. Again, that's Ma'ash Baruch Nefesh, and they felt, for obvious, I should have said this, for obvious medical reasons, the prevailing medical field today always says that a mother's milk is way better than formula, just from a medical perspective, and that because of that, you always want to encourage mothers to nurse their children. That's the shita today in the medical world. I'd say it's ironclad, but I'm sure there are people who disagree. So that's very much accepted in the medical world. Among pediatricians, they always want to encourage that. For many reasons, it's better. So, which makes sense. That's like the way God's system works. You know, you assume that Hashem Baruch Hu's system is going to be better than, not. Okay. The last part of Dash that I want to deal with, which is a very important to me personally, I don't know about for you, but for me personally, it's the topic of Mashkin Shizavu, and you'll see why this is extremely practical. So it actually comes from source 10, and it's a Gemara, which we'll just see. Zeisim Shemasha Mehen Shemen. So you have olives that Shemashach Mehen Shemen, that you have oils coming out. Anashmach Mehen Yayin, or you have grapes, that again, you have wines coming out. V'yachnisan Ben Locha Ben Lamashkin Hayotzeh Masur. And what did you do? You've gathered them. So it doesn't matter if you have a bunch of grapes, or a bunch of olives, and your goal is to eat them, or you want to eventually squeeze them, whatever oozes out of them on their own, right? Just naturally, would be considered asur. Now, that's not doraisa, because you didn't actually squeeze them, but any liquid that oozes out of grapes or olives would be asur. Tutim, I remember we saw there's three levels, right? This goes back a while ago. Three different levels. You have zesim and anavim, which are often squeezed. Then you have tutim, which are the medium. Then you have things that are never squeezed. So tutim is this middle section, tutim and rimonim. So tutim, berries of some sort. Shemashach mehen mayim. Or rimonim shemashach mehen yayin. Vechnisan le'ochlin etzem emuter. So these items, whether they're berries or whether they're pomegranates, or again, basically fruit that is sometimes squeezed, not always squeezed, and not never squeezed, and you put them aside to eat, because remember the rule with tutum and anavim, if you set them aside for juice, this will not be good. If you set them aside to eat, meaning you want to have a strawberry in your salad, you want to have pomegranates in your salad, which is also, you're very fancy, right? So you do that, and sometimes these fruits ooze on their own, be permissible. The mashkin v'lestam ayetzem mehen asur according to Rabbi Yehuda. Chachamim say regardless, ben the ochlin, ben the mashkin, whatever oozes out is permitted. So that's the Gemara. I mean, the Gemara has two categories, zesim and anavim, always asur whatever oozes out. Doesn't matter if it be designated for food or for drink. Whereas the middle category, tutim and rimonim, those that depend. That's a machlokes. Rabbi Yehuda holds that if you set them aside to eat, whatever is out is permissible. Although, if you set them aside to drink, it's forbidden. Chachamim said, regardless, whatever oozes out on their own would be forbidden. Okay? And now you're going to be like, well, how practical is this in the modern world that we live in, right? How much juice is really oozing out of our fruits that we have on the counter or in the fridge or whatever, right? And if it does ooze out, it probably means it's defective or that, like, it was thrown on the ground, right? Or it got squashed, and that's why liquids are oozing out. In which case, you might not eat it anyways. Or if it's nice weather, then you have flies there. What? Okay. So that's going to... That's exactly going to be what potentially it's going to matter. Very good. So source 11. Zeisim and Anavim, you're not allowed to squeeze. Which we saw. Right? Vim Yatsu Matsuman, if they ooze on their own. Asurin Afilu L'Hayu Omdim El. So this, again, makes sense, because there's a Simon and Ovin. They're like in the biblical, they're a tier A category. However, Tutim and Rimonim Asur L'Sachtan, right, this is not new, we've seen this before, you cannot squeeze these fruits on Shabbos. However, Im Yatsu Matzman, Im Omdim L'Achila Mutter, Im Omdim L'Mashkim Asur. So we see the Shulchan Aruch Paskins like Rabbi Yehuda against Chachamim. How is Rabbi Yehuda? Fine. Usharko peros, remember, that's this category 3. Mutar l'sachtan, right? And again, we mentioned this a few weeks ago. The problem is that we live in a world that loves squeezing. We have carrot juice. We have lemon juice. We have kiwi juice. We have blueberry, strawberry, banana, orange, peach, cocktail juice. I mean, we have anything that goes today can get juiced, you know, including carrots, which is pretty shocking because... Yeah, but you see, no, right? You see carrot juice. What do you, how many carrots do you need to get juice? You need a lot of carrots for a little bit of juice. They're not, I don't, most people don't need a carrot and be like, wow, this is the most, you know, succulent carrot I've ever had, you know? I don't know. But okay, whatever. What am I going to tell you? I guess, yeah. Now, says the Ramah, Ubamakam shenagul lishchot eze pera lishta miyamav. And again, I think we've seen this already. The Ramah says, but in a place, like in the modern world, which is today, any fruit that people started to squeeze, and you squeeze it for its juice, if you're thirsty or for enjoyment, has upgraded to tutim and anavim. And that's why today, all fruits and vegetables, basically, really hard to be find an exception, are upgraded to tutim and anavim. That is why we do not squeeze any fruits and vegetables on the Holy Sabbath.
That category to trickle down to also when it comes out by itself? Like, things were upgraded.
Okay. So it gets upgraded. Excuse me. But if it's, remember, hold the Rabbi Yehuda. So if it's for L'Achila, it's Mutter.
So, yeah, but not
Zeisim and Navim. Right. Zeisim and Navim, we're going to put in.
The upgrade is only when you speak to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah. Okay. However, you know, lischo lerefua levado in lachush. That's not applicable in the modern era. No one's like, oh, take this carrot juice; it's going to heal you or whatever. V'chozer davka lizgarasser ava mutter limtzos piv. You could put it in your mouth. You could even put a grape in your mouth and squeeze out. Right? Piv mina nevi mashkin shabahem. And of course, for anything else, but you would not be allowed to take a grape, put it in your mouth, suck it out, and then get rid of the grape. You just be allowed to suck out the juice while it's in your mouth, and then swallow the grape. But to take the grape and do this, that'd be a problem. Okay, now this comes up, and let's talk about grapefruits, because grapefruits, I happen to like grapefruits, although I didn't have as many grapefruits this year as I usually do. Grapefruit is a good snack that I like to have at night, as opposed to, you know, other unhealthy foods. Grapefruit's like a good snack to have. What people do, those of you that have never had grapefruit before, never had this chus, so what the issue is that when you have grapefruit, most of the time, you finish your grapefruit. Let me explain. You usually put a grapefruit in a bowl. Because if you don't put it in a bowl, it's extremely messy. So you put it in a bowl. This is how I do it. I take a grapefruit. I'll tell you my secret. I cut it in half. Then I take a knife, and I go all the way around, and then I do an X. And this allows you to scoop it out and eat it properly. Follow? Right? So you cut it in half, I'm happy to demonstrate one time, right? Take a knife, curve it all out, and then do an X, and this way you can scoot out the spoon. Okay? So, the issue is that when you scoot out the spoon, always grape juice spritzes out. Always. And the bottom of the grapefruit, when you finish eating it out, there's always juice that you have there. First of all, I made two cuts in it. Well, I made a circular cut and an X, and often I pierce it to the bottom, in which case it comes through the bottom. Or when you scoop it out, it flows out over the top. Just to... Now I realize I'm hungry, which is part of the reason. So, I had a banana. There's not a lot of juice there. Now, what about... Can you drink the leftover juice? Or, if you're zochet to have a fruit salad for dessert, generally speaking, at the bottom of your fruit salad, you have liquid. And there's grapes in there, by the way. Often you can have grapes in there. So the question is, can you have the juice from the grapefruit or from the fruit salad? And the answer is, you're permissible to do it. Why? Based on this principle. You have no intent. Now, even though it's going to be, it's 100% psik ratio. Meaning, you know, 100%, not sometimes, always, when you stick your spoon in a grapefruit, you're squeezing it, you're eating it, juice is going to flow out, unless you have a real pathetic grapefruit, right? So you know it's going to happen. You know there's going to be leftovers. And you know you enjoy it, but still it's mutter to do. And the reason why... is because, says the... Which I took the sefer and actually didn't open up to it beforehand. What's the reason why you'd be allowed to? What would be your rationale why you can have the juice from your grapefruit?
It's
for achila. What? Oh, but you know you're going to have a shtiyat hana at the end. No one does it only to drink. All that work for that spoonful of grapefruit at the end, right? That's absurd. So even if you know what's going to happen and you enjoy it and you want it, no one does it. Even though you have intent or you know what's going to happen, it's still considered derech achila. Yeah.
What if you enjoy the juice more than the fruit? Say.
But you would never do. Here's the thing. If you enjoy the fruit that much more, you would never do it that to a grapefruit. Like on a Tuesday night, let's say. You wouldn't go to all that trouble just to get that thing, right? You would take it, you'd juice it. You know what I'm saying? So to do all that, to get your half a spoonful of grapefruit juice at the end, even though you might enjoy it, it's still something which is...
Do we consider it a Yotzei Me'atzman?
And that's considered based on Yotzei Me'atzman. Because it's Yotzei Me'atzman because you're eating it. You're not juicing it. Right? If someone were to take a video of you, no one would say... no one would say, oh, look at him, he's juicing his grapefruit. No, you'd say he's eating his grapefruit, right?
What about the grapes in the fruit salad?
So even there, so... I gotta find it. It's right here somewhere. It's in a footnote. Also, meat shenir from alav. Oh, mutar la. How do you say grapefruit in Hebrew? Very good. Mutar lachtok eshkolit. Rachvav lachal bekapit, lerachva. No, lorachav lerachva. You have to cut it. You can cut it width, right? Like I see. Maybe I got it. That's where I got the tip from. I don't know how to eat grapefruit. I'll be very honest. I did not grow up with grapefruits. There wasn't any grapefruits when I was growing up. Now it's more. When I tell my kids, I never saw an avocado until I was 19 years old. I didn't know. I saw an avocado on a kibbutz in Israel. I didn't know what it was. It didn't exist. You know what? Hearts of palm, those things did not exist. Right? Things exist. Quinoa, I never heard of. Pomegranate seeds, never heard of as a separate entity. Never. And pomegranates was Rosh Hashanah only. Just have a pomegranate. Didn't exist. Listen, I lived in the olden days, right? The ein b'kach mishum isur shechita. Said there's no isur shechita going back to our grapefruits. Go look at Sif Yudalev. The hush omnam yizar melischota. You still have to be. You mean you can't say I'm eating it and then you're really squeezing it. Become lo yechavin davka lemitz b'shashir vocha. You can't have hinim vocha mizuman on my meats. No, you're having, you're eating it. Even though you know it's for sure going to happen. Here, this is the footnote. Here. He says, listen to this. Harei afilu im yischat otam b'yadayim, gam ken in bazeh elis or derbayim. Meaning, what he's trying to say is, let's say, even if you intended on squeezing out your eshkoliot for the juice, it's still an only nisr derbayim, right? Because the derbayim is only going to be zeitim or navim.
Going back to how things are upgraded.
So even though things are upgraded, yeah, they're still not upgraded to an Isser. That's actually not true. He says, he quotes here. And 2 minutes we have left, I'll find it. The Mishnah Berurah says, yeah, that the only time it's Doraisa, and this is the language I want to show you, it has to be omdim l'schita, since my grapefruit. So the only time a grapefruit is upgraded to Doraisa is, here's a grapefruit, this, I'm squeezing this grapefruit in an hour. No, I, right? These are my grapefruits of squeezing juices. That was the only taste. But if it's for eating or for squeezing, it's no longer Doraisa. So that's why, even though a grapefruit, if I end up squeezing it, if I designate to be squeezed, that could be maybe potentially an issue. But what you're trying to say is that if you, here's a fruit that you designated to eat, and now you decide to squeeze it, that'd only be a derabanan. That's what I want to just to be certain of that. Okay, fine. That's what he says. And that's what he says. Oh, a pre nischar ktsat b'sharach. I mean the footnote, by the way. When he says a pre nischar ktsat b'sharachila, that sometimes if a fruit is squeezed during sharachila, it's schita k'lachar yad. That's schita k'lachar yad. That's like a shinu of schita, because no one does schita with a spoon while you're eating, right? That's a k'lachar yad. The having trade rabbanans. It's two rabbanans. One is only the rabbanan to squeeze the b'yadayim. Two, it's shinui of squeezing because of the spoon. The whole of inu mitkaven is chot. You have no kavana. You're eating it. Shari. That's why this leftover juice is permissible. And he says it's oh. Betrayed Rabbanans, even a psik resha. So even though it's a psik resha, because you know it's 100% going to happen, since it's two Rabbanans, even by psik resha, he says, is permitted le chat chila. Since he's not becoming this chot, since it's arai, it's actually three. I don't know why he says two here. Oh, I think that's exactly his whole point. He says, and even if there's be two drabanans, it'd be permitted. And here you basically have three drabanans. And that's why he's saying it's totally permitted lechatchila to have your leftover juice. And he even says, that's what he's quoting the name of Shlomo Zalman Rabach, and he even, and it wasn't here, but I saw somewhere else that even if you have a fruit salad, and you have grapes in your fruit salad, since it's mamish, you know, mevatel, it's a little bit, same idea, it's kliyachaya, da-da, probably permissible if you have grapes in your fruit salad as well to have the leftover juice from a grape. Okay, let's end that for today. God willing, next week, new topic.